Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we'll hear about an investigation into how domestic violence survivors are sometimes punished for crimes committed by their abusers. A state law holds them accountable if they participate, even if it's under threat of harm. We'll talk with a Ukrainian family living in Illinois concerned about their future and the future of their country. The Trump administration has stayed busy, shaking up the federal government. We'll talk with an expert about how far Trump can legally go when it comes to blocking state policies. Also, Chicago's mayor went to Capitol Hill to testify before a House committee. A reporter tagged along and has a report. The U.S. Postmaster General is leaving that job. We'll hear how his plan to consolidate operations has been received. And before he became an icon of the Old West, Wyatt Earp lived in Illinois. We'll have those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A 2024 investigation by the Marshall Project found over 100 cases of survivors who were punished for a crime committed by their abusers. The cases that were found in Illinois involve a little-known law called the Theory of Accountability. It allows a person to be prosecuted for another person's crime if they assisted or helped, even, in some cases, if that help was provided only under threat of violence. The Marshall Project's Shannon Heffernan explains, and a heads up, this story includes descriptions of violence.
When Patricia Johnson met Ray Travieso, she was only 17. He was 35. But she came from a poor family, and he made sure she had what she needed. Stable housing, medicine for her mom. Once he gave Johnson a beautiful pair of earrings, gold and dangly. They were a symbol of his ability to provide for her. But one day, in the parking lot of a Sizzler restaurant, the meaning of those earrings changed. Johnson offhandedly complimented another man's car, and Travieso got mad at her for giving him attention.
So when we got out of the car, he knocked me down. He hit me so hard, the earring flew out of my ear, and I was trying to look for it. But I wasn't really looking for the earring. I was so embarrassed, I didn't want to go into the Sizzlers.
After that day, she said the abuse escalated. A shattered glass table, a belt buckle to the face. Johnson's niece, Tremika Turner Mason, was just a kid. She remembers how her Aunt Patricia seemed so young and lively. Johnson took them to the beach and brought them junk food.
Love to go to Dunkin' Donuts. Oh my goodness, that was like our thing. I got like obsessed with jelly donuts.
But eventually, as Johnson was with Travieso, those outings turned to sour.
This particular day, I was like, oh, I really want to go to Dunkin' Donuts. So she was like, yeah, we can go. So we went to Dunkin' Donuts. We went back to her house, and Ray got there, and he was angry that day.
Angry because Johnson wasn't home when he called. Turner Mason could hear him beating her in the next room.
I had already started eating my jelly donut, and I just threw up.
To this day, Turner Mason doesn't eat jelly donuts. Johnson says Travieso had incredible power over her life, monitored her so closely that fearing him was almost like fearing God. On the afternoon of January 16th, 1992, 7 years after they met, Travieso asked Johnson to come with him to take care of some business. He drove her to the house of his business partner, Juan Hernandez. They went to his living room where Hernandez's wife, Olga, was sitting with their baby, Evelyn, on her lap. The two men started arguing about cash. Then there was a knock at the door, and Travieso pulled out a gun.
There was some type of delivery, and I think it was a pizza man. And he told me exactly to say, the order's been canceled. Say it now. And I said, the order was canceled. And he said, sit down. And I seen a lamp over in the corner, and I thought about picking it up. And I said to myself, if I pick up that lamp and hit him and he doesn't fall, he's gonna kill me. I pondered on that lamp.
Medical examiner's reports show what happened. The parents were beaten and their throats were slashed. The baby was bashed to death. Johnson says after Travieso killed them, he told her to gather up jewelry and put it in a bag.
And he looked at me, and he said, you're going to take this to your grave with you, right? I said, you know, I won't say anything.
Travieso did not kill Johnson that day. But in a way, he still took her life. Since 1993, she has been sitting in a prison for those murders. She's serving a life sentence, just like Travieso. Prosecutors didn't have to prove Johnson laid a finger on anyone to send her to prison. Because of Illinois' theory of accountability, Johnson was guilty if she assisted Travieso, even under duress. I tracked down one of the jurors in the case, who asked not to be named out of fear for retaliation from Travieso. Watching the trial, two things were clear to this juror. One, Johnson was there at the murders and provided at least some support. And two, Johnson would have never done anything like that if not for Travieso and his control over her.
There was more than three victims. Of course, the family was victimized, but she was a victim too.
Still, the juror felt like she had to follow the law. Ultimately, the jury came back with a guilty verdict. She remembers crying with the other jurors.
And it was very difficult to reach the consensus we had, and it was difficult to be forced to follow those rules.
Travieso has changed his story over time about what happened, at one point directly implicating Johnson in some of the murders. But when I wrote him in prison to ask him about it, his answer was short. He said Johnson, quote, should have never been in prison. All these years, I felt bad about it all. I found nearly 100 cases like Johnson's across the country, where a person, almost always a woman, was incarcerated for assisting, supporting, or failing to stop a crime of their abuser. The survivors often had clear signs of abuse at the time they were arrested. One Illinois woman was in a neck brace. Some Illinois lawmakers and activists have tried to change the theory of accountability so people are not punished the same way as the person who actually committed the act. At a hearing last year, State Representative Will Guzzardi spoke in support of a bill that would narrow the law.
We can't hold people legally responsible for the actions of everybody around them that they couldn't possibly have any foreknowledge of.
Another Democrat, Dave Vella, pushed against it.
You're accountable for the people you do nasty things with. And if something bad happens, you should be accountable for the bad act.
The law failed to pass, but activists say they are still pushing for change. Since the conviction, Johnson has come out as a trans man. He still uses she, her pronouns when discussing his past life and asks that we do the same because he says living as a woman was central to the abusive dynamic with Travieso. Johnson is now 55 years old and has spent more than half his life behind bars. Prison can be hard on a body. His teeth are in bad shape and he sometimes uses a cane. But he says he no longer fears Ray Travieso, no longer thinks he's as powerful and omniscient as God. Instead, he prays constantly, on calls with his family, with women who come to his cell for help, with his lawyer during meetings, and at the end of our interview. Johnson says he owes it to God to be brave.
That story produced in partnership with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization focused on the U.S. criminal justice system. Hundreds of parents and some of their children rallied at the state capitol this week, demanding continued investments in early childhood needs. As part of an annual advocacy day, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who spoke at the rally, says the state is already doing better for its youngest kids.
We put $250 million more dollars into early childhood block grant. Under Smart Start Illinois, we created 11,000 new pre-K seats as we work to end preschool deserts.
But Governor Pritzker has suggested level funding for early childhood block grants next year. That means the state could not add more pre-K spots in underserved areas like it has in the last 2 years. Education funding overall would get a boost under Pritzker's proposal. The governor has championed proposed legislation that would allow community colleges to offer bachelor's degrees for in-demand career fields. Illinois' two-year institutions could offer four-year degrees in programs such as nursing, early childhood education, and manufacturing.
To build an economy where every Illinoisan can get ahead, we need an education system that can meet people where they are, regardless of their age, regardless of their background, or their zip code.
24 states, including Indiana and Missouri, already allow community colleges to offer baccalaureate degree options. More than 6 million Ukrainian refugees have left their home country due to ongoing war. 250,000 have come to the U.S., but the program that allows them to be here has been paused since President Trump took office in January. Stephanie Mosqueda with Illinois Public Media brings us the story of one Ukrainian refugee family in East Central Illinois and the uncertainty they now face.
3 years ago, Yevheni and Tatiana Ivaskevich, who go by Jean and Tanya, lived in Vilitserva in central Ukraine, surrounded by their family and loved ones. Tanya worked for the city, and Jean was a quarry manager. But in late February of that year, everything changed.
It was February 24, and at 4:45 a.m., we heard attacks, rocket attacks to our city.
That day, Russia launched a ground and air attack on Ukraine. Russian troops invaded from the north, east, and south. Jean and Tanya and their two sons, Matvey and Jorgi, packed quickly and went to Jean's father's home in the center of the city.
We saw the military base from our windows. It was terrible, and now it's terrible. Every night there are drones, rockets.
2 months later, the United States announced the Uniting for Ukraine program, created to provide a pathway for Ukrainian refugees to come to the U.S. for 2 years on parole. Tanya says she worried about her family's safety and also about her kids' education. As the war dragged on, they were going to school, but the schools operated primarily as safety shelters. Not much instruction was happening.
Everything we do, it was for children. It is now, and it was for children.
To qualify, they needed to get permission from the Ukrainian government. Men between the ages of 18 and 60 aren't allowed to leave under martial law unless they qualify to leave due to a medical condition. Jean was hospitalized, and because of that, Tanya says he qualified.
He had surgery on his heart, and he could leave Ukraine.
The next step was to find a sponsor in the U.S. who would agree to be financially responsible for them. Just over a year ago, they completed a profile on Welcome U.S., a portal that helps connect willing sponsors with refugees. As they waited, more than 5,000 miles away, the Joya family in Champaign had applied to become sponsors. Penny Joya and her husband Les are owners of the Joy of Illinois farm. Since their kids have grown up and moved away, the couple opens their home to those in need of housing and other assistance. Most recently, the Ivaskevich family. It took several months and lots of paperwork. But finally, the family booked flights and arrived in Champaign in September.
On September 25, we had an appointment for schools, for make physical exams for us and for children. Everything, Penny prepared everything.
There was a lot to navigate. Signing up for health insurance and applying for work authorization and a driver's license. Even something as simple as applying for SNAP, a federal food assistance program that refugees qualify for, took multiple attempts.
We talked to this guy and he said, no, you can't. Danny showed him a paper. He read it, then said, I need to talk to supervisor. Then he returned and said, you can.
The family found a church in Mahomet and made friends with other Ukrainians in the area, some of whom helped Jean find a job at a plastic fabrication company.
My favorite part, it's a meeting with our new friends. The people are so kind.
After 3 months, the family felt ready to try living on their own. In January, the day after President Trump took office, they moved to an apartment in Mahomet. A few days later, the Trump administration announced that the Uniting for Ukraine refugee program was paused and would not accept new applicants, and that immigration officials may start reviewing the cases of people like Jean and Tanya, who are in the U.S. on humanitarian parole. It's unclear if the program will be unpaused or terminated completely. That's something Les Joya thinks would be unfair to people who are fleeing incredibly difficult circumstances. It would also be bad for the economy, says Lisa Wilson. She leads the refugee center in Champaign.
Refugee resettlement is a very good thing for America.
She says without immigrants and refugees, the U.S. population will decline, and the jobs that many businesses rely on immigrants to fill would be left vacant.
Immigrants have always taken the hardest, most menial jobs in our society. And that hasn't changed. Without immigrant labor force, we are going to see these jobs unfilled on farms, in meat processing plants, all over the country. So this is a huge need that we have for this immigrant labor, and I'm really afraid that this will have a serious effect on the American economy.
Wilson worries not only about the future of refugees coming to the U.S., but also about how those who are currently here will find support. When the Trump administration announced it would be pausing programs like Uniting for Ukraine, it also suspended funding for refugee resettlement programs. Right now, the Refugee Center is not getting reimbursed for services it's currently providing to thousands of refugees in Champaign-Urbana. Wilson says the center may have to cut its services soon unless something changes. The Refugee Center's parent organization filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration, alleging the funding was illegally suspended.
So we have hope that hopefully our courts will uphold this legal system of immigration and certainly pay us the money that we are owed for doing this kind of resettlement work.
As for Tanya, she has started classes at Parkland College in nursing. She hopes to fulfill her dream of working in medicine. The family recently visited the Joyas for dinner, spaghetti with red sauce and ground beef, cooked by Penny. Les said a prayer to bless the food, and while they ate, I asked the boys how they felt about their new school. 16-year-old Matvi told me he really likes it. His mom Tanya prompted him to share more. Tanya says they fear for the families back home, especially when they hear news of the ongoing war. And they worry about whether they'll be able to reapply for permission to stay in the U.S. once their 2 years are up. But right now, she says they're focused on rebuilding their lives and grateful for the friends they've made and the generous support they've received along the way. I'm Stephanie Mosqueda, IPM News.
Still ahead, a law professor weighs in on the Trump administration's lawsuit against the state of Illinois. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Some legal experts say President Trump is pushing the envelope when it comes to asserting federal power. The administration is taking Illinois to court over its laws limiting cooperation between law enforcement and federal immigration agents. But can the federal government actually block state policies? To find out more, Mawa Iqbal talked with Nadav Shoked, a Northwestern University law professor who studies the powers of local government. He starts by telling us about the importance of the Constitution.
So for anything that the federal government does, it has to pinpoint a source for that action in the Constitution. Now, if they can find such a source, so a basis for the action that Congress or the executive or the president took, then whatever they did is supreme to state laws. However, if they do not have a basis for their action in the Constitution, then they just can't do it. So it's a power that the 10th Amendment just states it. But then it means that if it's not in the Constitution, it's a power that's left to the states.
So in our legislature in Springfield, you know, we have these lawmakers saying that they want to protect access to abortion and gender-affirming care and environmental regulations. And of course, like we're talking about, immigrant communities. So I guess in what ways can they do that under a Trump administration that is actively trying to roll these policies back?
So where the state has the strongest, just in practical terms, the strongest footing is when it comes to issues of enforcement. So the federal government cannot force the state to use its police, either the state police or local police forces, to enforce federal laws. And that's exactly what we're seeing now with immigration. So Chicago, Cook County, and the state of Illinois are saying, we're not telling you, the federal government, that you can't have these immigration policies because that is a federal power, but we're just not going to enforce it. Another thing that the state legislature can do in almost all these causes, whether it's with respect to undocumented immigrants, whether it's with respect to whether it's to women seeking abortions or people seeking gender affirming care, is money. The state has its budget, and the state can give that money to whomever it pleases.
So speaking of money, right, is that a way that the federal government can try to stop some of what the state of Illinois wants to do just by withholding federal funding?
So last time around, the real limitation that they kept, the federal government kept hitting its head against was that a lot of the funds that are allocated to states and localities are allocated based on federal statutes, so congressional acts that don't leave too much discretion to the executive, so to the president, to DOJ, or whatever department. There also is the chance, I mean, it's much more difficult to prove from the perspective of states that at a certain point, if you withhold money in such a way that it's almost like a gun to the head of the states that they have to adopt the federal policy, then you could have a federalism issue, that is to say, a federal intervention with state powers in an unconstitutional manner. But that's a high bar to clear. With this administration, who knows? So yeah, maybe they will.
It seems like the Trump administration basically has two courses of action if they want to stop a state from doing something. So it's the money, which is getting tied up in the court system right now, but also then it's their own lawsuits, like bringing, you know, the state to court with this DOJ lawsuit against the city of Chicago, Cook County, and Illinois.
Yeah, so this is a brand new move. This is not something we saw 8 years ago, these kinds of lawsuits. And that's clearly pushing the envelope. From their perspective, you can't win a lottery without buying a ticket. So yes, their legal argument might not be that strong, but you're going to make it anyway. That's the only way to win. But this is really where they're doing something that they did not do the last time around, and that from a legal perspective is much more adventurous.
Nadav Shokhead, a Northwestern University law professor who spoke with Mawa Iqbal. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson was on the congressional hot seat this week. He testified before the House Oversight Committee on Capitol Hill about that city's sanctuary status. Mariah Wolfel spent time with Johnson in D.C. throughout the week and brings us this behind-the-scenes look.
The night before the hearing, Johnson, the son of a preacher, called on three D.C. area pastors to pray for him. They gathered in a circle at the National League of Cities building as I hit record.
I think I'm going to start. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, we come to you today.
They asked for his appearance to be easy, to be effective, and for his adversaries to be disappointed.
In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen.
Bless you, man.
After, I was Johnson's last appointment before the big day, and I asked,
What's something that tomorrow you can say to me, I told you so, Mariah? I told you I would nail that point, and I did.
The city of Chicago is safer. It is.
We're not asking our police officers, our brave women and men, to do the job of the federal government. Getting that message through will be my focus.
And it was. Throughout more than 6 hours of questioning alongside three other mayors, Johnson told committee members violent crime is down, which it is, at least 18 times.
Violent crime is down in Chicago.
The city ended 2024 with its lowest homicide rate in 5 years.
We are a safer city since I've been in office. Crime
safer
is down.
City. Okay.
Crime has gone down since I've been mayor.
Johnson prepped for hours, training himself to stay on this message and others, like the city's law doesn't violate federal statute. In Chicago, he is often criticized for repeating the same talking points like this, and his somewhat robotic answers made him appear nervous in the hearing at times. But sticking to the point that there is no proof that sanctuary city laws lead to more crime was perhaps more effective in this setting, in the face of a lot of aggression. It gave committee members less to work with and left viewers with that key takeaway. On the flip side, it made Johnson the target of some particularly personal attacks, like from Republican Representatives Nancy Mace and then later Darren LaHood of Illinois.
Mayor.
Any individual that
yes or
causes
no.
harm
yes or no.
breaks
okay,
the law
Mayor Wu,
should be held accountable.
This is why you have 6% approval rating, because you suck at answering questions.
Your approval rating speaks volumes.
Well, the people approve of my investments, and I will continue to make those investments.
You're
Thank
going
you
the
much.
Wrong direction.
Johnson sat with his hands folded, eye contact with the questioner for most of the hearing, and mostly avoided clapping back to any of the insults. But it was not a flawless performance. At one point, Congressman Byron Donalds is asking Johnson how much the city has spent to support migrants. In his prep, Johnson was advised to give a percentage instead of a raw number to paint how small the amount is in the broader context. But it might have left people wondering whether he knew his facts.
You're the mayor. You don't have the math in front of you.
It's 1% of the overall budget over the last 4 years.
That's why you're a failing mayor.
Which is the same number that was sent from us from
the state of Texas. Illegal immigration? Mayor Johnson, I already asked you. You don't have a hard number. And if you don't have a hard number, you're not running your city well.
Overall, Johnson was happy with his performance, though. I met him in a committee room after the hearing to talk about it.
But yesterday I asked you, you know, like, when I talk to you tomorrow, what are you going to be able to say I told you so about? And I think the first thing you mentioned was that Chicago is a safer city and crime is down. I did not expect you to mention it in almost every answer that you gave. But why did you feel that that was important to highlight?
As mayor of the city of Chicago, it's my top priority to protect the residents of this city. It is. And everything that I am doing, of all of these.
In his answer, as you can start to hear, Johnson repeats the same talking points. But he goes on to note that the message wasn't just for committee members. He was using the platform to get a message back to the audience at home.
I need Chicago to know that what we're doing is working, because it's going to take all of us to continue to build a more inclusive economy and safer communities for everyone.
After, Johnson walked across the street, his first breath of fresh air in at least 8 hours at that point, and looked elated as a crowd of supporters gave him a round of applause.
When I say shy, y'all say town. Shy.
Town.
Shy.
Town.
Mariah Wolfel, WBEZ News.
Most but not all universities are holding firm in the face of President Trump's threats to diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in higher education. The University of Illinois Chicago and University of Chicago have maintained DEI offices and programs, but Northwestern has removed the terms from several websites. The Trump administration has attacked efforts to make campuses more inclusive in what is called a Dear Colleague letter from the Education Department and two executive orders that are currently held up by the courts. Lisa Corian-Phillip talked through these developments with the legal scholar Jonathan Feingold. He signed on to a memo from law professors across the country, urging university leaders not to capitulate to Trump's threats.
What was your response to the executive orders concerning DEI and then the Dear Colleague letter?
I was caught off guard by how grotesque the language was, which is consistent with the Trump administration and the way in which many of Trump's closest advisors openly use the term DEI hire and DEI as a like only thinly veiled slur to suggest that like all women and people of color and women of color in particular are just presumptively unqualified. One of the reasons why institutions have become more proficient and competent is because various DEI sorts of policies have actually broken down all sorts of mechanisms of exclusion that meant you were not actually getting the most talented and qualified people in the door.
Tell me about the memo that you signed on to and kind of what prompted you all to put that together.
There were reports daily of universities scrubbing websites, of folding up shop, of reassigning personnel, of simply folding and failing to hold the line, failing to marshal any sort of meaningful defense of a whole range of policies that, again, aren't just lawful, but are mission critical. You actually can't achieve the goal of robust and open inquiry and discourse and teaching and learning if you're not creating environments that are free from racial bias, stigma, stereotypes, and harassment. It is wholly permissible and consistent with federal civil rights to take steps to promote racial diversity and racial inclusion. Equity.
I've been tracking local universities' responses, and Northwestern especially has been scrubbing DEI from websites.
It's deeply troubling for some of the most well-resourced universities in the country that are needed now more than ever to actually defend democracy, to be offering like unpersuasive rationale. My sense is that most universities just want to duck and cover and hope that the administration doesn't come after them, because universities want to avoid investigations. They want to avoid the financial cost, you know, I understand that. And the PR hit that, you know, comes with being in media headlines. but as a matter of sort of how to strategically respond to an authoritarian administration that is bent on snuffing out any political resistance, it's a terrible strategy. It also communicates to all university stakeholders that they are not in any way the priority.
That was legal scholar Jonathan Feingold in a conversation with Lisa Korean-Phillip. The head of the U.S. Postal Service announced recently he's stepping down. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy will continue in the job until his replacement is found. He backed a plan for the service to consolidate operations, especially in rural areas. But as Hector Alejandro Arzati reports, that's facing a lot of opposition.
It's a long drive from the road to get to Kyla Estes and her family's house in southeast Missouri, about a mile and a half. And it's even more of a drive to get to the nearest town.
We're about 5 miles from Mark One, about probably 15 miles from Patton. We're out in the middle of nowhere.
Estes is a third-generation farmer. She and her husband love living out here, raising their two daughters. But there are challenges. The nearby post office is only open for 4 hours on weekdays. And Estes says the quality of service from the U.S. Postal Service has gotten worse in recent years. It's taking longer for things to arrive, or they don't arrive at all.
I ordered a dress for my daughter's Christmas concert, and she didn't get it in time. I got the shipping label in the mail instead.
The family also runs a business in Patton that sells parts for trucks and stock trailers. She says postal delays have become a big frustration for their customers. So when Estes heard that USPS had a new proposal to further trim operations in rural communities, she was fed up.
There's some major things there that need to be addressed as far as getting rural America our mail in a timely fashion.
The USPS is trying to save billions by consolidating operations over a 10-year period with a plan dubbed Delivering for America. Among the proposed changes, to decrease afternoon mail collections at post offices more than 50 miles from regional hubs. That would severely cut back service in most rural parts of the country. The plan has drawn major opposition, including from the American Postal Workers Union. Kimberly Carroll is president of the Iowa chapter. She says workers are already struggling to do their job effectively.
We've already seen a slowdown in delivery in the state, a gross slowdown. It's just mind-boggling.
Carroll represents about 900 small post offices in Iowa. She worries there could be a negative impact to local economies, especially where agriculture is crucial.
I really do fear for the survival of small towns in the United States, especially in Iowa. Some of them are holding on by a thread right now, and the thing that is keeping them in existence is the fact that they have a postal service.
Even as Postmaster General Louis DeJoy announced his resignation, he has asked that his replacement move forward with the plan. At a meeting for the Board of Governors earlier this month, DeJoy said it will save USPS almost $4 billion.
It is time for us to act before it is too late to save the Postal Service.
I don't want to tell you, out of 330 million plus people in this country, that the only one that supports this is the Postmaster General and his staff, but it almost seems that way.
Tom Day is one of the members of the Postal Regulatory Commission, an independent agency that spent months reviewing the plan. The commission's report said the plan's modeling is flawed and overestimates savings. Day spent 35 years working for the USPS, including at the national level.
I am critical not because it's having a problem and I want to see it fail. I'm critical because I want to see it succeed.
Day says he knows it must change to survive, but not at the expense of rural customers. In rural Kansas, USPS is too important to fail, according to Nick Lewandowski. He's the executive director of the Kansas Farmers Union, which represents about 4,000 members, mostly row crop farmers and cattle ranchers.
It is a service to the American people, and we expect that service, and we don't want to see continued cuts and consolidations made.
The Farmers Union called for DeJoy to resign. Now that he has, they're hoping whoever steps into the position will make sure the post office keeps operating in rural America. I'm Hector Alejandro Arzate.
More to come on Statewide. Stay right here. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Member station WGLT serves the Bloomington Normal area, and the station has a recurring segment that spotlights unsung heroes called More of That, Please. In this edition, Melissa Ellen reports on members of the nonprofit Not Alone Notes, a group of people with obsessive compulsive disorder who write letters to others with the same disorder.
When New Jersey resident Lisa Jeffrey opened her letter from Not Alone Notes, she says her OCD was on the brink of becoming disabling. She'd looked into treatment, but had not mustered the courage to start any therapies. That's what she told the nonprofit when she requested her letter. Jeffrey says the response was beyond her expectations.
It said something like, "We know how hard it is to face these exposures, and you're really brave for doing this." And I was like, okay, if other people can do it, and they think I can do it, then maybe I'll give it a try.
Jeffrey says she credits the letter and its writer for helping to start her, quote, OCD journey. Morgan Rondinelli of Normal wrote the letter. She also has OCD and founded Not Alone Notes, which sends handwritten letters like the one sent to Jeffrey to help people struggling with the disorder. People with OCD have frequent and unwanted thoughts or fears, which lead to repetitive behaviors that interfere with daily life. Rondinelli says she got the idea for Not Alone Notes in 2017.
And I put a Google form on my blog just saying, like, hey, if you have OCD, give me your address and I'll send you a note just of encouragement. And people started requesting them.
This all happened during Rondinelli's senior year of college.
It just was out of my dorm room with a stack of stationery.
Rondinelli estimates her registered nonprofit has sent over 3,000 notes to people with OCD so far. Today, around 10 people are on the team. Lisa Jeffrey, who started as a note receiver, is one of them. She's become the treasurer of the nonprofit. Rondinelli says it's important for all the volunteers to either have OCD or have intimate experience with the disorder.
Our main message is you're not alone, so you have to be able to know what it's like to say that.
Rondinelli says there are many misconceptions about OCD, and her symptoms go beyond typical perfectionism. In high school, she would reread assignments to the point of memorization. Rondinelli says she also has intrusive thoughts, which come without warning and force her to react with certain behaviors.
I used to have a lot of fears around driving, just like, what was that bump? Was that a person? And then you drive back and you're like, oh no, it was just like a piece of plastic or whatever.
Not Alone Notes co-founder Molly Fishback says Rondinelli's brainchild has helped her to create a community of people with OCD. When she joined a Zoom to speak with WGLT, she had a photo of a young Rondinelli with her dog in the background. She says it was from a recent virtual birthday celebration for Rondinelli, who's become a friend. That's despite living in the Boston area, while Rondinelli lives in Normal.
It's funny being friends with someone halfway across the country with each other, and we've only met a handful of times in person, but we've made it work.
Lisa Jeffrey, who's been one of hundreds of recipients to receive one of Rondinelli's handwritten notes, says she considers her a friend now, too. From her first face-to-face interaction with Rondinelli on Zoom, Jeffrey says Rondinelli was kind, friendly, and inspirational.
It's very nice to know that there's someone out there who cares so much about so many people who, like, she doesn't even know any of these people. You know what I mean? Like, she started this project to help strangers, and that's just such a beautiful thing.
Rondinelli says she wants to continue growing Not Alone Notes. She's already started a care package initiative, sending mostly donated items to people recently diagnosed with OCD. She does that once or twice per year. Rondinelli says Not Alone Notes is funded entirely through monetary and in-kind donations. She and everyone else on the team is a volunteer. She says it takes her around 20 minutes to write each letter, and they're never typed.
When I write the notes, I picture like the hope and encouragement and joy coming through to the note itself. I kind of think of like sending that through the ink.
When people request notes through Rondinelli's platform, their responses get added to a spreadsheet. At a desk in her house, she says she sits down for an hour, goes through the responses, and writes what she would want to hear. I'm Melissa Ellen.
For more information about Not Alone Notes or to sign up to receive letters, visit notalonenotes.org.
State lawmakers are trying once again to come with financial incentives to spur low-income housing developments. Eric Stock reports similar efforts have failed in the past, but advocates believe the situation has gotten so bad that their idea has met its moment.
There is a shortage of nearly 300,000 housing units for low-income Illinoisans. That's according to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. So lawmakers are reviving an effort that's been tried several times before. The Building Illinois Homes Tax Credit Act started its first push 5 years ago. The bill would provide a tax credit for private developers to build low-income housing. The program would cost the state $20 million annually. The credits wouldn't be distributed until a development is finished and occupied. Democratic State Representative Dagmara Avalar is the chief sponsor. Avalar says the bill has not passed in prior sessions due to budget constraints and getting lost in the shuffle. But she says the program is financially beneficial since it would produce jobs and private investment.
If we are able to do this, the economic impact of creating this tax credit, it's huge. It would support the development of over 1,000 affordable homes and apartments throughout the state of Illinois.
Avalar came to the state legislature from the nonprofit sector, where grants are a lifeline. She says grants are more likely to be Band-Aid solutions than long-term policy.
And I truly think that we need something that provides us with the stability in the long term to be able to bring more investment towards affordable housing.
The Illinois Housing Council lobbies for affordable housing across the state. The council worked with Avalar to help craft the bill. The Housing Council's executive director, Allison Clements, says the bill was modeled after the federal low-income housing tax credit. Clements says that made it easier for the Housing Council to support. Clement says the federal program works, but state incentives could provide additional help.
It's an important resource we have available to build and preserve affordable housing throughout the state and country.
In a panel with the Illinois Manufacturers Association a few months ago, Clements talked with manufacturing leaders across the state. They told her the lack of affordable housing has affected their workforce.
They're seeing amongst their members who are employers around the state, they're struggling with attracting stable workforce because of lack of affordable housing worker retention as well.
Clement says the program could be beneficial for the Bloomington Normal manufacturing industry. Republican State Representative Ryan Spain of Peoria is the chief co-sponsor of the bill. Spain says the tax credits could bring business to Illinois while also addressing the housing shortage.
We're not exactly bursting at the seams with economic growth. We need to make sure that we're providing opportunities to make the development of housing more successful. And it's been slow in Illinois for many years now in terms of new housing starts.
The request comes at a time when the state faces a projected $3 billion deficit. Spain says regardless of a deficit year, housing is a major need.
We have a lack of affordable housing to the tune of over 300,000 units, and we need to make some investment and indicate our priorities so that this can be corrected.
Spain says the bill has bipartisan support, saying there were Republicans who voiced support for the bill last session, but it never got to vote. Democratic State Representative Sharon Chung of Bloomington says she has signed on to the bill because of Bloomington Normal's housing shortage.
There's not really like one magic bullet that's really going to help the issue solve to get solved. So, you know, this is, we need a sort of like any number of tools in our pocket to help with it. So this is one of those things that I think could really help attract developers.
Chung says getting the bill passed will be difficult, but the housing shortage is a complex problem. She says the culmination of COVID, slower supply chains, higher interest rates, and the rapid expansion of the Rivian electric vehicle plant in Normal all contributed to Bloomington Normal's housing shortage.
All those sorts of things sort of led to the perfect storm of why we're in the shortage of housing and why it's going to take a little while for us to get out of it, to be perfectly honest.
Chung says revenue streams such as regulating fireworks and legalizing gaming terminals in Chicago could help offset the cost of the program. With reporting from WGLT Capital reporter Cesar Toscano, I'm Eric Stock.
Before Wyatt Earp became a famous Wild West lawman at the OK Corral, he was a common crook in Peoria. Earp's checkered legacy in the River City is just one topic of Dr. Vicki Loberg's book, Peoria's Bad Habits, which highlights some of the city's less savory characters and events. When the book came out, Tim Shelley spoke with Loberg about Earp's time in Peoria.
he was a ne'er-do-well, actually, and they had bad things to say about him in the local newspaper. They called him a bummer, which is essentially another term for vagrant.
What exactly earned him that reputation?
Well, it goes back a ways. There were actually at one time probably three IRPs in Peoria. The 1870 census shows his brother Virgil here as a bartender at a saloon in Bunker Hill, which was in the red light district. And Wyatt ran into trouble with the law out west. There are a couple different versions. One thought was that he was escaping an arrest warrant, that there was a warrant out for him for misappropriating money when he was the town marshal. He didn't put it in the school fund. And then there was another story that he stole a couple horses. So all of a sudden he appears in Peoria, likely attracted here because his older brother was here.
In Peoria at that time, just to set it, we're talking, what, late 1860s, early 1870s? It's kind of an infamous town, so to speak.
It was known as a wide-open frontier town, which is not uncommon during those years. It's very interesting. The Peoria directories list Wyatt Earp living in a brothel. Washington and Hamilton, it was Jane Haspel's brothel. There were many brothels. Peoria was kind of known for its red light district.
So what was Wyatt Earp doing in Peoria while he was here?
Getting in trouble. Some historians suggest that he was also a pimp, recruiting prostitutes. There's not a lot on that. He mainly appears in arrest records. Haspel's brothel was raided by one, I think his title was either Detective Gill or Sheriff Gill. And one of the prostitutes who was also arrested at that time turned state's evidence to reduce her sentence or her fine. And then later, she was found dead. And, of course, there were rumors that, well, perhaps Wyatt Earp had something to do with that. He was here not very prominent again until another raid, and he was arrested with his brother. His one brother, Morgan, seemed to be around with him. The two of them seemed to be getting in trouble and arrested. And so there were another series of arrests. They went to court, and Wyatt requested a change of venue. And he got the court date was changed to another judge who had never tried one of these type cases before. So I suspect Wyatt knew that the previous judge would have perhaps given him a harsher sentence. But so they paid the fine, and they were done. And then during another arrest, they didn't pay the fine, and so they had to go to jail. And the newspapers really played that up, that he had to spend time in the calaboose and so forth. And eventually after that, it seems that Earp left Peoria and went on eventually to have his fame at the OK Corral. And of course, no one understands. The whole image of Earp is based on the 1950s TV show Life and Times of Wyatt Earp, played by the very handsome Hugh O'Brien. And, you know, the song that says, brave, courageous, and bold, long may his story be told. Not so much.
What can we take away from his time here? Was that what impact did that have on him later in life, or did it have an impact on him later in life?
Not that we could tell. But he continued his association with prostitutes as he went further west, and supposedly was married to one that was mentioned there. I mainly limited my time to his time in Peoria, but it was amazing when you do read further ahead. That was just his style of life. That was his lifestyle.
That was Dr. Vicki Loberg. She was speaking about Wyatt Earp and her book, Peoria's Bad Habits. We'll be right back. Well, we've run out of time once again on Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.